Your local radio. Across central southern Dorset. Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Hello and welcome. We're live in the studio and ready to go with the show. Now, first of all, we shine a light on Littlemoor, Weymouth's troubled neighbourhood where good things are happening. We introduce a new feature, Meet the Movers and Shakers, who make things happen in our area, starting with the man who's brought changes to Weymouth's much improved fishing industry and more.
And while on the subject of fish, there's grim news for lovers of fish and chips. The chippy is being battered by higher overheads and looming fish supply problems, so much that it's estimated 40% might close. We talk to two fish and chip business owners in Weymouth. And we hear from our two stalwarts, Ruth on gardening with views on transplanting, and from our poet at large, Jim Potts, with readings on the subject of war.
First of all, Littlemoor, the neighbourhood to the north of Weymouth, bounded by the Littlemoor Road and the railway line, has got an unenviable reputation, and I deliberately use the past tense in recognition of the fact the community is pulling together to make it a better place. Readers of the local newspaper will be familiar with headlines reflecting mainly the behaviour of young people, spiced up with reports of periodic, unexplained vehicle fires and broken shop windows. It shares with Weymouth and Portland instances of social deprivation and low wages. But it is the quality of life there that I've invited into the studio Councillor Louis O'Leary to talk about the area he represents. First of all, good morning. Give us a snapshot of Littlemoor.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on. Littlemoor is the northmost area of Weymouth. It's situated between Upway and Preston. It's just south of Bingham. It's a area of roughly about 3,000 residents. It's largely a mixture of social housing with a number of broad properties in the estate and on the outskirts. Its historic makeup is of a typical housing estate. I'm very proud to be born and raised on Littlemoor and know the area very well, and I've got a tremendous amount of family on the estate. It was originally built as a small farming area. There was a number of farms dotted around the area. During the First World War, though, it was used as a Anzac Australian Army camp until World War II, where it was once again used as another army camp. A lot of the roads, such as Canberra, Brisbane, Rockhampton, all bear the names of Australian cities in tribute to the Anzac forces that served and were stationed there. During the 1950s, it then became a council estate. The council built a large number of houses between about 1955 into the 1980s. The estate doubled in about 1970. You start with the old estate and then doubled to the upper estate. In 1980, we were very lucky to get the first ever shopping precinct in Weymouth, which opened with some of your listeners may remember Key Markets is one of the names of the time. And then we've had a number of businesses over the years, banks, hairdressers. We've got a very good hardware store there at the minute, and hairdressers, a chemist. Morrison's are now going in there. So there's a lot going on the estate.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, isn't it? That I've noticed, because I live not far away, that the popularity of Littlemoor has sort of ebbed and flowed, because there were times when there were virtually no shops there at all because the supermarket, which was the main attraction, had closed down, and, oh, that supermarket site changed hands so many times, Co-op, Budgens, etc. But now things seem to have settled down, and I have to say that there's a very large car park and it is full in the mornings. So things have changed, but we can't get away from the fact that it has had in the past a pretty ropey reputation. I mean, the police, you know, for a bit of memory, always seem to be around. So what's the situation at the moment? Is there still a crime epidemic?
We had a series of incidents towards the end of last year, leading from the summer up until Christmas. The crime reports for November and December were 39 reported incidents of ASB, which doesn't sound like an awful lot, but it's very much focused in certain areas, and that's only reported incidences. The real issue was trying to get people to report them in, which we did, and we've got a very good local officer force, and I would say that things are definitely on the decrease. I mean, crime reported statistics are down from 39%, like a 39 in November and December, down to 14%, which when you actually do it, that's it's 14 for the whole of this year from January. So it is a massive increase of around 65% at the minute. There are still issues, and there always will be some issues, but we're going in the right direction, and that's the main thing.
I mean, is it youth crime in the main?
Largely. It's a number of young people, number between 10 and up to 20, and with an age group of around 8 to, I'd say, about 17, 18. But what we've done is we've done two things. We took a two-pronged approach. We had we made the police aware of the incidents we were reporting, and it was down to them to do the job properly and firmly, which they've been doing. But also the other side is a community trying to work with the young people one-on-one through. We've got a youth club, we've got a number of community events, community groups. Dorset Council have been doing their youth outreach program. I mean, one of the youngsters that was causing a tremendous amount of trouble, he's been taken under by Dorset Council, and he's, you know, his life's changed. He's much better position now. So I mean, there's a number of things we've done, and we're going to continue to do them to make sure it stays on the right track.
Now, talk about the community. There are a number of activities that are planned and in fact are happening at the moment. Am I right in thinking that quite a lot of money has been, pumped into the community?
So we were given £1 million around 10 years ago from the lottery. That's gone in. That's controlled by a group called Big for Littlemore, which I used to be a member of that, but now I attend their meetings in my capacity as a ward councillor. Over the years, they've done a number of things, such as the memorial garden towards the relief road, which is a fantastic testament to them and a real tribute to the men and women who served in the armed forces, as well as taking into that account the Anzac heritage on the estate. Also, we've done things like the growing garden at the Tot Club. They helped us get the youth club reopened with grants. They provided grants to a number of other groups. For a number of years, they also ran the community centre. So there was that. But other than that, we've not got a tremendous amount of funding from anywhere else other than that. That is changing. I mean, I'm really battling for grants at the minute. I'm passing every grant I can get hold of onto various community groups. Whether it be grants from the Police and Crime Commissioner, Dorset Council, Weymouth Council. I just submitted a grant for Weymouth Council today for funding for a Jubilee event. So we're trying our best. But there's not been, other than the money from the lottery, which was 10 years ago now, there hasn't been anything recently that's contributed to this.
So you're handing out your begging bowl, are you?
I am at the minute. No, we're just asking for... a number of other areas of Weymouth do get a lot of support, and I feel like sometimes a little more, because it's on the outer edges, and because it is, for instance, Westham is a lot bigger than Littlemore, and Westham gets a large, I would say, from certain forms, a larger amount of funding than Littlemore does. But Littlemore has is a number of issues. It's third in the deprivation ratings in the county, behind only Malcolm Regis and Underhill on Portland. So it is... A very deprived community in a lot of ways, but we have a very strong community, and to be honest with you, we've always been quite self-reliant. I mean, the community centre at the minute struggles to remain open, but it remains open due to the self-reliance in hard work, not through any sort of money being pumped into it.
When you talk about deprivation, I mean, what is the sort of visible manifestation of that? Because if you walk around Littlemore, you know, the houses seem to be well kept. I mean, there's a certain amount of litter, but there is anywhere and everywhere. But you don't get the feeling that there's social deprivation there. Our appearance is deceptive.
It is. I mean, I grew up in a family that was, you know, just a normal working class family, and we always maintained that our house was clean and our garden was kept tidy. But, you know, sometimes you do struggle, and especially at the minute with rising prices and the fuel issue and things like that. But I set up the first food bank on Littlemore during lockdown, and you'd be surprised the amount of people that come in, and a lot of them are people that work. A lot of poverty that people are facing are people that are in work, because in work poverty is the problem, you know, a mixture, and that's Weymouth's problem, low wages, insecure work, and that's what really affects Littlemore.
So you've been the councillor for Littlemore for how many years?
I was elected in May 2019.
Right, and if you had a wish, and I'm going to wave a magic wand, or lend you a magic wand, what would you hope for in the future?
For Littlemore, or in terms of just the council in general?
Well, let's say Littlemore, because let's stick with Littlemore.
Littlemore, I don't want anything other than... I'd love it for people to just take what the good news stories are and put them over the bad news stories are. I mean, if you actually matched up the good things that happen on Littlemore compared to the bad things, you'd be way outnumbered. I mean, we do such a number of events, and people are finally recognising that at the minute. And I notice there is a change in opinion on Littlemore. There is a more positive opinion coming towards us at the minute. I feel that anyway.
How does that manifest itself?
Well, I just think when I talk to people, I think the lockdown year, I mean, we did, we did more than any other community, and I might upset other communities, in to help each other, I feel. And I think we got recognition for that. I think the recent reports of crime and whatnot has set that back a bit. But when I talk to people, they say, oh, you know, there's an awful lot going on a little more. And other councillors, I mean, I have one councillor from another party, he said to me, I'm very envious of your community. He says, you've got a tremendous community. You know, and I walked around with another councillor from another party, and he was, you know, amazed at the amount of folks I knew and what was going on, and how, you know, now people knew everybody, and it was, and he was very envious.
So Littlemore is sort of rising above the problems. And in the future, it seems to me that whenever you go to Littlemore, more and more building is going on. And that's private housing, isn't it?
A large part of it is, although a third of it will be social or affordable. But well, then once again, it depends what your class is affordable. I mean, but a lot of it is. I mean, we still have a lot of social housing on the estate, and I'm a big supporter of social housing. And we've hopefully got an Astor development coming to the area, which will be almost completely social and affordable. And I'm pushing for a return to, once again, fully social developments. A lot of people say they don't like them, but I think they're very good things, and it keeps communities together. So, I mean, there are issues with the developments on infrastructure and on services in the area, but I'm trying to address them at the minute.
So anyway, so I think what we're going to do, Councillor O'Leary, Louis O'Leary, is wait and see and invite you into the studio, perhaps this time next year.
Yes.
Find out how much improvement or how the improvement has continued. But thank you very much indeed today for popping in to see us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
And now it's a change of space, because we're... what we call hot seating here, because Ruth has now taken centre stage. She's planted herself in front of the microphone. And Ruth, we're going to be talking about gardening and transplanting, I think. And Andy tells me he wants to transplant the whole of his garden.
Good luck with that. Sorry about the delay. I was just answering a quick query. Yes, transplanting. This is a brilliant time of year to transplant certain plants, because the soil, it's been dampened by rain, although it has been quite dry recently, and the soil's warming up, so it's a nice, welcoming, hospitable place for new plants or plants that have been moved. I mean, I have actually been doing a lot of transplanting over the last few weeks, but I've been transplanting my hardy perennials that have come back. I haven't been transplanting shrubs or roses, because they're now growing. And if you move them now and they're starting to grow, they may not flower as well this year. It might just knock them back a bit. So you might have to wait 12 months to get a decent
right
display.
So let's examine in detail. What are the reasons for transplanting?
There's several reasons, really. You may say you've got a plant, a perennial, that has outgrown the place you put it in originally. So you may want to move it somewhere it's got more room. You may want to divide it and replant the divisions elsewhere in the garden. And you may have a plant that isn't doing particularly well in the site where it is, and if you've fed it and watered it and looked after it and it's still struggling a bit, it might be worth moving it elsewhere, or even potting it up for a few months so it in some fresh compost so it will grow in a nice, safe, secure environment, and then putting it back in the soil elsewhere where you think it'll grow.
I've got a current problem, a hydrangea.
Mm.
It's a very old garden, and I think the problem with very old gardens are that people have planted things without really thinking that they're going to grow bigger. And I've had to move a hydrangea from against a wall because it's just not doing well. It's leaning over. It's a very old plant. Have I done the wrong thing?
I hate to disappoint you, John. I wouldn't have transplanted. But depend when you did it. When did you do it?
Sunday.
Yeah, I would probably, because is it just starting to put on new growth? And
yes, but slowly, because that's part of the problem.
Well, that's hydrangeas for you. That's hydrangeas for you. They are quite slow. I would have left it. I would have pruned it, left it for this summer, and probably moved it in the autumn.
Ah, now thereby hangs a tale. I was told you don't prune hydrangeas.
Yes, you do. You do.
Oh, you do.
They don't need much pruning. Most of them, it depends, you say. I don't need much pruning. If it's grown completely out of shape and has got too much, you can hard prune it right back to the ground almost. Maybe do it a third a year over 3 years. And this will encourage new bushy growth in a decent shape. If it's in a good shape already, all you need to do is in sort of mid-spring, sort of between now and middle of April, is cut back the old flower heads to a healthy pair of leaf buds, because the old flower heads have been sort of protecting the new growth through the winter when it gets colder, because hydrangeas can react badly to very cold conditions. So when it reliably warms up and it's warmer at night, you can just cut it back then to a healthy pair of leaf buds.
So unfortunately, I've done the wrong thing. I think I might have done another wrong thing.
I'm going to get you a pointy hat with a D on and stand you in the corner.
I see. Right. Do you really like coming in here every week?
I love it. I love it.
Right. Andy's chortling away there because I take the mickey out of him about his garden. I have been moving some roses.
Where have you moved them to and from?
I've moved soil to pot, pot to soil.
Again, are they just starting to grow?
They're
budding, they're shooting.
Yes, I mean...
Yeah, I'd have probably left it till the autumn. Because when they go dormant, you see, and then there's nothing to disturb, they're dormant, they're sleeping, they can sometimes... It can just throw them a bit when you replant them. Takes them a bit of time for the roots to get re-established in the soil, so they may not flower as well this year. And with roses, you should never move them to soil where roses have grown before.
Oh dear.
Because they suffer from a condition called replant disease, which is a really strange problem, and no one's really quite sure what causes it. But I think with roses in particular, microbes build up in the soil, and when you move roses, established roses, or indeed plant new roses in soil where roses have been grown before, it can completely throw them out. It, worst case scenario, it could kill them. So if you really have to put a rose where a rose has grown before, you need to either completely change the soil with fresh topsoil, fresh compost, or plant it in a cardboard box in the soil, fill the cardboard box with fresh compost, and over the length of time, the cardboard will disintegrate, and that gives the roots time to get established healthily.
Yes, I think the problem is that you can make an assumption that a garden is big enough to have space where you can always find new soil, new areas. And that is a problem because gardens are not big. I'm lucky I've got a big garden. I should have asked you this question at the end of last year. But there we are.
Yes.
It is.
To be fair, this week I've bought loads of topsoil from the garden centre because I need to feed my raspberries and the soil's shocking. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what other advice do we have? We're talking about transplantation. Any other hints?
Right. I love transplanting plants, because it can be so satisfying. If you've got something that isn't doing too well, you move it and it suddenly gets a new lease of life. My top tips for successful transplanting, and I'm talking perennials here, you know, things that come up every year.
Okay, list a few to help people who aren't familiar with the term.
Now I've gone completely blank. Knapweed, penstemons, I wouldn't say dahlias because they're bulbs and tubers, but a herbaceous perennial, like a chrysanthemum or a helianthemum that comes up every year,
yeah,
you can move them successfully, echinaceous.
Oh, got a question about dahlias. Mm. I've had to clear a bed for various reasons, and I've dug up the dahlia tubers.
Yeah.
Is that the right thing to do? And can I plant them somewhere else?
Yeah, you can. You can. Or start them off in a pot of compost, multi-purpose compost, and they'll start shooting, and then you can plant them back in the soil.
I mean, it sort of almost comes under the heading of transplanting.
It does.
Do you have to plant them or put them in the soil now, or can you put them in the soil later on? If you put them in now, will they flower this year?
Yeah, they should do. They should do, yes.
So don't delay. Get them in the soil.
Yes. And if you are transplanting, I would always say water your plant well first. When you dig it up, dig widely around it so you don't damage any of the roots. So there's still quite a bit of soil attached to the roots. Add some fertiliser or manure to the new planting soil and plant it at the same depth as it was before and water it well.
Ah, yes. Now, there's a point. I think you mentioned it very briefly in a previous programme about the importance of depth when you're planting. People don't dig deep enough. Is that so?
It's not a case of digging deep enough. It's, say when you buy a plant from the garden centre and it's in a pot,
mm-hmm.
it's grown in that pot, it's developed what we call a root ball, which is the compost around the roots in the pot, and you take it out of the pot, plant it in a hole that is the same depth as the pot it was in before, because plants don't like going in too deep and they don't like being planted too shallow.
So that's your guide.
That is the guide. And also, when you do plant or transplant something, don't be alarmed if it sort of droops and looks sad for a few days afterwards. It's just the shock of the move, and it will soon regenerate.
And plenty of water, I think, is the...
Yeah, keep watering. Don't let it dry out. And don't let it get weedy.
Feeding? Sort of Miracle-Grow and things like that?
I would put some sort of a granular fertiliser in the hole at planting time,
yes.
Or some bone meal, because that's very good for roots. And then during the flowering season, probably a liquid feed with tomato fertiliser every fortnight, yeah. Say.
Ah, that's a point. If you go into a garden centre, you'll see on the shelves things for roses, which seem to be quite expensive. I'm talking about liquid fertiliser, etc., etc. And go to another part and there's tomato produce,
yeah.
Much cheaper. Is there any reason to buy more expensive rose fertiliser than tomato fertiliser?
Roses are really hungry plants. Tomato fertiliser, which is good for, I mean, they call it tomato fertiliser, it's high in potassium, which is good for anything that flowers or fruits. Because that's what potassium does, it helps flowering and fruiting. So I use tomato fertiliser in my containers, in my pots, in my hanging baskets, in everything. I do have some rose fertiliser. It's one of the perks of the job. I do sometimes get sent samples. But generally with my roses, I just use a general purpose.
So
blood, fish and bone, or, you know.
And in our armoury, what should we have to combat the various rose diseases and bugs and things? Give me a couple of brand names that people will recognise.
Right. The most common problem with roses, disease-wise, is black spot, which is a fungal disease that turns the leaves yellow and then black and then they fall off.
Is that terminal for the plant?
No, it's not. It will weaken it. It will reduce its vigour. It's not terminal, but you can get various products, and you put me on the spot because I can't. Rose Rescue is one, which is very good. And there's also a product called Fungus Fighter that will be good against rose black spot.
And what about bugs in roses?
I use my fingers. It's mainly aphids. I squish them off with my fingers.
Really?
Oh, rose sawfly is another one. Again, squish them off. I prefer not to use pesticides. If you don't like the thought of squishing them between your fingers, then I would get an organic bug killer.
Well, providing you wash your fingers before you have your sandwiches, I think it's probably all right.
It's just extra protein, isn't it, though, John?
Of course it is.
One more thing about roses: when the leaves fall, if it has black spot, collect them up and throw them away. Don't put them in your compost bin because the spores, the fungal disease, will spread. And then mulch well over the soil because the spores will get splashed up onto your rose by rain and it will continue the cycle. So if you put down mulch, it buries the spores, so it's less of a problem.
Ruth, pots of advice as usual. Thank you so much for coming
in. It's been a pleasure.
And we look forward to seeing you next time. And Andy has taken note and he will be busy in his garden.
Thank you very much. It's been
great. Keep 106, your local radio.
Now it's time to start our new series, which we're calling Meeting the Movers and Shakers. People in our area who've made a difference, those who've contributed by imagination and hard work to successful outcomes and benefit to the community. Good things are happening on Weymouth Harbourside. Visitors will experience new restaurants and cafes with sitting-out dining areas and a road surface made good by lifting the old railway lines. Whilst being of historical significance, and many do regret their disappearance, but their slippery surface were hell on wheels for unwary cyclists. Now, 2 years ago, we followed up a report aired by BBC Television which indicated the local fishing industry was in decline and that disgruntled fisher folk, you can't call them fishermen anymore, were claiming the prices paid for their catch were hardly covering costs. Not so, exclaimed our first mover and shaker, Sean Cooper, the relatively new owner of Wayfish, who describes how the Weymouth fishery transformation is a success story. Here he talks to John.
Well, this is the story of a man who came to Weymouth to buy a pub and ended up doing something completely different. Sean, the microphone is yours.
Well, thank you very much, John. What can I tell you? We moved down to Weymouth 10 years ago and we were wanting to move to an environment where we were thinking about retirement. And my wife said to me, you need some sort of a business interest down here. And I thought, I know, I'd really like to own a pub. I asked a colleague of mine to see if he could find me a pub. There's a lot of pubs in the Weymouth area. And he came back 3 months later and said, I can't find you a pub, but I can find you a fishmonger's. Is that any good for you?
And this was Wayfish of old, and my goodness me, haven't things changed?
Yeah, I think so. So we bought the business in December 2017, and you know, really, that what was attractive was that this this building and this business is at the absolute heart of the Harbourside community, and absolutely a key facility to the local fishing fleet, and that was the thing that really attracted me.
Now, I don't want to be disrespectful of the business that was here previously, but let us say that it wasn't in any shape or form as desirable a place to go and buy your fish as it is now. So what difference have you made to this beautiful building on the harbour side?
Well, I think before I comment on that, I think what I would say is that, you know, Bob Goodwin and Colin Horn, who were the two owners of Wayfish, in their day were innovators. They took this building in 1985 and created Wayfish. And at that time, it was an absolutely thriving, fantastic business. Sadly, Bob passed away late last year, and Colin is you know, in his late 80s now, and so they, I think, just ran out of steam a little bit with this, but their passion for the fishing industry and the fishing community was always there, and that's something I'm pleased that we've been able to inherit. What did we do? We set about really just re-engaging with the fishing community. So we wanted to make right at the core of what we do here for it to all be about the sea, for it to start and finish in the sea, and that means having a close relationship, a partnership, if you will, with all within the Weymouth fishing fleet.
Now, we first met 2 years ago in 2020, right at the beginning of COVID, and the thing which, stimulated the interview was the fact that the BBC, on a local television programme, had said that the Weymouth fishing fleet was failing, that prices of landed fish had been reduced by up to 75%, and I came to see you, and you cried foul. Not the case at all. So what is the situation today? Because COVID is, well, still with us, but we don't have the restrictions. How many fishing boats are landing here at the moment?
So we have a core nucleus of fishing boats that land to us that are around about 30 boats. If we cast our mind back to the conversation we had in May 2020, there were two things going on at the time. What the BBC were reporting was what was happening at the main fishing auction houses, the Brixhams, the Plymouths, the Newlands of this world. What we did right at the beginning of COVID was to designate Wayfish as an essential food business. We then made it our business to stay open every day, 7 days a week, to serve the local community who couldn't get out of their homes, and we did that by being able to do local deliveries. But what we said to the local fishing community was, bring everything here. Don't worry about what's happening to prices down at Brixham. Here's the prices that we were paying to you before the pandemic hit. We'll guarantee those prices, whatever happens to the volume of fish and shellfish that you bring. And the more you bring, the more that gives us the responsibility to deal with that. And that's how we then moved into things like building an online website where people can order fish from all over the UK from Wayfish, and we can courier that with FedEx, and then we invested in an electric delivery vehicle, and we do local deliveries DT 1 to 5 on a 5 days a week. And so it was things like that that came out of the adversity of the pandemic, where it bound us all together so that we could keep the fishermen fishing and we could keep the local community served with fresh local fish.
Can we just go back a moment or two and talk about exporting fish to the rest of the country? Exactly how does that come about and how do you do it?
So we have a website that allows people to go on, pick the fish that they want, see images of the fish, understand how it can be portioned, and they can buy by a portion, they can buy by weight, and they can literally complete that order process online, like you can if you're buying a pair of jeans. That comes through to the shop overnight, and in the morning we print out those orders, we make those orders up. We vat pack every piece of fish for the customer. We put it into polystyrene boxes with blocks of ice, and then we seal that all up in a nice branded Wayfish bag, give it to FedEx, and FedEx deliver that on a 24-hour turnaround.
That's amazing. I mean, it must be useful because so many supermarkets these days have got rid of their fish counters. I think maybe one locally has a fish counter, but certainly Tesco's have just got rid of theirs. So is that driving people into your shop?
It certainly did over the course of the pandemic. I think that now that most of the restrictions have lifted, people have gone back to their normal ways of life, and so we're not seeing quite the traffic of people into the shop or through the online ordering. I think just to focus specifically on online ordering, the difficulty that we've experienced is the second we give a beautifully wrapped, packaged box of fish to FedEx, we're effectively handing our reputation to a third-party provider. And of course, over the pandemic, with everybody shopping online, the reliability of the service from all of the courier services wasn't what it needed to be. And the second you get a box of fish that lands 2 days later, it's not what it should be, and customers don't respond well to that. So, you know, FedEx have let us down a little bit, but you know, we still have a core customer base that likes to order from as far afield as Scotland, the Midlands, and certainly a lot in the southeast that buy from us.
Now, what about prices that you're paying to the fishing people?
Well, we review these fairly regularly. We're in touch with the fishermen. We talk to the fishermen on a daily basis. They'll be the first to tell us if it's not competitive. Let me tell you, they're not shy when they want to make their point. We'll always have an eye on what's happening at Brixham, because we send fish to Brixham if there's too much surplus here. So we get the daily records of what prices are doing down there. And we also, you know, we like to think that not only are we paying the right money to our fishermen, but we're also providing ice. We provide bait at cost, and if there is a surplus of fish that they've landed, we'll put that into ice trays, and we'll get that to Brixham for them, and we don't charge for that service. So I think it's a real partnership effort rather than just a commercial relationship.
Now, when we were talking earlier, the question of dirty money cropped up, and I say dirty in inverted commas. You've made some changes there, haven't you?
Yeah, I think, when the pandemic hit, you know, my biggest responsibility was to our team here. And the last thing I wanted to do in a world where we were designated as an essential food business, where everybody was still coming to work, was to have any risk of transmission of the virus into our staff. We effectively created a work bubble. And one of the biggest transmitters we felt at the time, and still believe today, of the virus was the handling of cash. And we thought that people wouldn't want to take that risk. We certainly didn't want to take that risk. So we got rid of cash, and we introduced a contactless payment system. And that's going from strength to strength, and really does provide a great service to us. We're not having to handle cash whilst we're serving customers, which then makes our hands dirty. We're not having to count cash up at the end of the day. We don't have any security risk. Everything we take just goes straight into our bank account the next day, and it's a much more convenient way of trading, I think, for our customers and for our staff.
Now, we talked about the fishing industry. Let's talk about this magnificent building, which won an award from the local civic society, because you now have a restaurant. Tell me more about that.
Well, from a building renovation perspective, I cannot tell you how proud we were to get the annual award from the Civic Society. We worked very closely with a conservation architect, Ken Morgan, who's recently retired, but you know, as part of that, he takes on projects that he really feels passionate about, and was able to help us. I've worked with Ken a number of times on a number of listed buildings, and so he was fantastic. What he's enabled us to do is create a whole new first floor in the building, if you like, a mezzanine floor, where we've created a business called Catch at the Old Fish Market. We were, you know, the quality of the build just celebrates all of the architectural heritage of this building, which is just fantastic. We got an executive chef to join us straight out of Mayfair, Mike Naidu, absolutely fantastic guy. This is his first opportunity to run his restaurant. He's come on board. He's built a fantastic team. Most of them local people, looking for that fine dining, you know, really quite intricate chefing experience. Mike's able to train and to teach people in how he wants things. And the quality of the food is just exceptional. Within 4 months, we were recognised by Michelin, and we made our way into the Michelin Guide for this year. But we were told of that in October of last year, 4 months after opening. I could not be more proud.
So you're looking forward to your first Michelin star, are you?
Well, you know, I don't think you can run a business just to get an accolade. I think you have to run a business for every single customer that's going to come and experience what it is you have to offer on a daily basis, and you have to be that good every day. If that were to result in something like a Michelin star, I think that would be absolutely fantastic for this area, because what that does is it creates a reason for people to visit Weymouth. And, you know, as a coastal community, you know, the winters can be hard. And if we can create something where people from further afield are going to travel to us, particularly in the off season, which we have this winter, people from London and Birmingham and Bristol coming just to dine at Catch, well, that can only be good for the community.
Now, of course, at the other end of the scale, you have a little hatch on the harbour side, haven't you?
We do.
Which is for tourists, I take it?
Well, you'd be surprised. I think our local customer base loves what Hatch does. Hatch is street food, it's seafood street food. We serve some beautiful small dishes out of the kitchen here, but we also have a barbecue grill out the front, and literally oysters, scallops, and barbecued lobsters, and people just love it. It's quintessentially English seaside. If it's not fish and chips, you know, because lots of people do fish and chips. We don't want to do fish and chips because we don't want to compete and add into that market. So how can you offer something different? Because we own our own boats, because we have the relationship with the fishermen on the harbour side, we're able to land quite a lot of lobster, and we're able to let local people and tourists alike come and sample the freshest lobster cooked simply with painted with butter and grilled, and proves to be very popular.
Now, I can see the enthusiasm, I can feel the enthusiasm. Sean Cooper, what's next?
Well, I think that's a fantastic question. I've got lots of ideas. I have an ongoing conversation with Jamie Joyce, our new harbour master, about the opportunity to put a lobster hatchery down here. I think that would be a fantastic reason to visit Weymouth. You know, that's worked very well in Padstow, where they have a lobster hatchery, and that's a real tourist attraction. And I think that that's something, because we've got the boats, because we've got all of that knowledge and skill on how to look after shellfish, then we are best placed to do something like that. I need a space on the harbour side. Jamie's promised to have a look at that for me, so we're looking at that. One of the other ideas that we have is to put a dining experience on a Dutch barge on the harbour side, and so we're working with him on that idea as well.
Sean Cooper, is there no stopping you? Thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
Yes, thank you very much there to Sean Cooper. Now, has the chippy had its chips? Much has been written about the possible fate of the fish and chip shop near you, with the question, how much longer can it continue trading? There's a crisis facing the nation's favourite food, and the expression, as cheap as chips, no longer has a place in our lexicon. The chippy has been with us for about 150 years, and until recent months has provided a meal that's been both sustaining and cheap. But not anymore. Huge price increases and escalating running costs have battered the trade to the extent it is reported up to 40% of the 10,000 businesses in the UK might have to close. We talked to two Weymouth chippies to find out more. First, Paul Hay of award-winning Fish and Fritz in Weymouth Town Centre.
Now, I've got a headline of a newspaper in front of me, and it says, "The Death of the Chippy?" So what's your take on that, Paul Hay?
Okay, it's a tabloid, and they want a headline, and that's what they've got at the moment. I don't personally agree on that.
And so what the comments it's making is that there are about 10,000 chippies in the country, and they're saying that about 4,000 of them are at risk of closure for all sorts of reasons. And it does seem to have the support of the National Fish Fryers Association for that sort of comment.
Yeah, I believe maybe there's about 850 premises up for sale at the moment, throughout the whole of the UK. But that is in line with, that's quite normal at the moment. It's not to say that there won't be more, be an increase in that at a later date with the present climate. But then again, that's for another day. So at the moment, there's, about 10,500 fish and chip shops throughout the whole of the UK. I think 850 maybe is a good representation.
Right, because as far as I can see, there are about 15 dedicated chippies in Weymouth and Portland. How are they doing with regard to business? Because there are all sorts of pressures at the moment, aren't there? And one of the things is that the price of fish and chips nationally has certainly gone up. And one of the points that have been made is that, this is a staple food for British people, and that it is actually quite sensitive. Are you finding that the fish and chips are price sensitive?
Yeah, I can't speak for other businesses. I can only speak for myself. We found a massive increase, especially over these last few weeks, probably over the last month or so since January. Prices have increased, and we have been forewarned that they will be increasing again further. So with the price of oil, with the price of fish, and the crops situation and all those sort of things, yes, it is quite a concern, for not just for myself but most of the businesses as well, I would have thought.
So I mean, if, when they say the death of the chippy, I mean, the point is people regard fish and chips as a cheap meal, and I know, because I'm a regular eater of fish and chips, so I'm not disparaging the quality or the quantity. In fact, the quality and quantity where I get my fish and chips is always very generous. But are people shopping around, or are they trying to find prices now? Are they anticipating that they won't visit you quite as often?
Yeah, I think fish and chips has, has been years ago was a very cheap meal, because that was that's the way it was, quite a few years ago. But things have changed now throughout the world, and trying to get to source these the quality that we're after these days, it adds to the price increase. So yes, with the sustainability that we're all striving for, to try and get the right product, the purchase of oil and all those sort of things that are coming from far-reaching places, then obviously there's a price to pay for that. That is the increase. So it's not a cheap meal anymore, and those prices will further increase. So that's the way I see it at the moment.
Can you see the sort of the £10 portion of cotton chips on the horizon?
Well, definitely. The present climate at the moment, we're hearing with the gas prices and electricity prices going up, fuel prices going up. I know that, hopefully there may be a cap on some of that, but until that actually happens, then that has to be passed on somewhere, and unfortunately it's passed down to the customer. With other outlets available, other food outlets available, those costs will be passed on to those people as well, to those particular outlets, and we'll all take a big hit on that, I would have thought.
Can we just talk about supply? Because it was an eye-opener to me that, in fact, 30 to 40% of fish that is fried comes from Russia.
Right, okay. Yes, it certainly does, but then there are other areas and different countries to buy your supplies from. It depends on where you get your purchases from, so that's where we shop around.
I see. But, I mean, is there a view that Russia can no longer supply because of trade embargoes and sanctions?
That's quite right. From what I've heard, embargoes and sanctions are coming into place, so we should no longer be able to purchase those particular brands, So, yeah, but I already get mine from elsewhere, so I'm quite fortunate at the moment. But that's why I pay a little bit higher price for my fish.
I see. Can you just remind me, because your shop has won several awards. What have you been doing in terms of success in various competitions?
How have we been doing?
Yeah.
Quite well, to be quite honest. Customers are on the increase. It's good to be at the forefront of the public eye and to make sure that we're still keeping our standards up there with the desired take on it. And we're open 6 days a week at the moment. Hopefully, going back to 7 days a week, just purely because of demand. But the other side of it is, unfortunately, we can't get the employees through the door. Staff is quite a bit of a problem, so that's our only holdback at the moment. But people are still coming through the door. It's still a favourite dish of the nation. Friday nights especially, Saturdays, the weekend when people are relaxing and are walking along the harbour front or the seafront, then, that's a big take of our taking. So.
Well, it's reassuring. So visitors to Weymouth in the summer can be sure of fish and chips.
Of course, yeah, by all means,
Well, hey, thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgway Magazine.
No, you're very welcome.
For a different take on the chippy crisis, I talked to Mark Bennett, whose restaurant and takeaway is a landmark on North Quay in Weymouth. He also operates fish and chip catering vans. He told me the price of a portion of raw cod had increased recently by 75 pence and rising, but there is a further supply problem looming as Icelandic fishing quotas are coming to a seasonal end. Russian caught fish, which would normally replace the cod supply, will no longer be available because of trade sanctions. He was saying that the £10 portion of cod and chips is going to be with us shortly, if not already. And to put this in context, he said that the ingredients of a pizza cost about £1 to £1.50. Will the pizza be the new cod and chips?
I hope not.
Me too.
Now, we've saved the best bit till last. Our Ridgway Magazine poet at large, Jim Potts, is with us, and he's chosen the subject of war for his readings today. Jim, all yours.
Thank you, Andy. Imagine that you're imprisoned and oppressed in an occupied country, and that the invading army forbids you to speak your own language, whether it's Kurdish, Ukrainian, Welsh, or even your own Dorset dialect. This is from Harold Pinter's play, Mountain Language, and it's an officer talking or shouting at a group of women prisoners. Now hear this. You are mountain people. You hear me? Your language is dead. It is forbidden. It's not permitted to speak your mountain language in this place. You cannot speak your language to your men. It is not permitted. Do you understand? You may not speak it. It's outlawed. This is a military decree. It's the law. Your language is forbidden. It's dead. No one is allowed to speak your language. Your language no longer exists. Any questions? The next piece is by Martin Niemöller. Actually, there are many versions attributed to him, but this is the version that I've chosen. First, they came for the Jews, but I didn't speak up because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the communists, but I didn't speak up because I was not a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I didn't speak up because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, but I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me. And by that time, no one was left to speak up. A Soviet Russian poet who was out of favour with the regime, called Osip Mandelstam, wrote a poem called Through Kiev in May 1937. This is just a brief extract from the translation by Clarence Brown and W.S. Merwin. Through Kiev, some wife's trying to find her husband. The Red Army trundled its wounded out of town on the last streetcar, one blood-stained overcoat calling, "Don't worry, we'll be back." Leo Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace, wrote an essay called From Christianity and Patriotism in 1894, and he said, "In all history, There is no war which was not hatched by the governments alone, independent of the interests of the people, to whom war is always pernicious, even when successful. Rudyard Kipling asked the question, if any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied. Another Russian poet, Yevtushenko, wrote a poem called Lies, which was translated by Robin Milner Gulland and Peter Levi. Telling lies to the young is wrong. Proving to them that lies are true is wrong. Telling them that God's in his heaven and all's well with the world is wrong. The young know what you mean. Wilfred Owen wrote a wonderful poem called From Anthem for Doomed Youth. This is just the first verse. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns, only the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries now for them, no prayers nor bells, nor any voice of mourning save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells and bugles calling for them from sad shires. Time for one more little poem?
I think one more, Jim, yeah.
Okay, well, Siegfried Sassoon's The General is a little bit more ironical. Good morning, the general said when we met him last week on our way to the line. Now the soldiers he smiled at are most of them dead, and we're cursing his staff for incompetent swine. He's a cheery old card, grunted Harry to Jack as they slogged up to Arras with rifle and pack, but he did for them both by his plan of attack. That's enough on war for today.
Thank you very much indeed, Jim. What have you got planned for next time?
I'm waiting for inspiration and for John's tip.
Put it down to me. Can I finish with a little joke?
You
do
can.
You think after that very serious reading. So down the King's Head, a group of blokes were around drinking when a mobile phone on the table rings. One of the men picks it up and he puts the speakerphone on. A woman's voice says, how are you, darling? I do hope you don't mind, but I've just seen a diamond ring priced at £2,000 and wondered if I can buy it. I've got your credit card with me. Is it all right? Of course, my dear. Go ahead, answers the man. While I'm on, purrs the lady, I've noticed a top-of-the-range car I'd rather like to buy. It's only £65,000. Do you think I could have that as well? Of course, my angel. His friends around the table look at each other in disbelief as the lady continues, and I've just noticed a house with a sea view in Lyme Regis. Oh, dear lover, it's £750,000. Can we have that as well? Of course, sugar, answers the man without so much as blinking. The phone call is ended, and the man smiles as the others take a long, he takes a long swill of his beer, and then he looks around and shouts, anybody know whose phone this is?
Oh, that had to be. Very good. Thank you for that, John. Just remind us where the joke came from.
Oh, it's a dear little book, actually. You can get it at the Poundbury Garden Centre, and it's called Bradwell's Book of Dorset Wit and Humour. Publisher is Maximilian Gate. I turn it over. It's £3.99. And it's got in it, and we have been reading these jokes from time to time, 70 pages of short jokes.
Wow, fantastic. And that brings us very nicely to the end of this edition of Ridgeway Magazine. Thank you for being with us. Do join us again if you can next time on a Wednesday at 11. But for now, from John Shepherd and me, Andy Venton, until next time, cheerio.